This week on Family Anatomy, Anatomy of Loneliness Part 2 with Dr. John Cacioppo.
The hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. You can find us on familyanatomy.com or you can look for us on iTunes, and we are once again talking to Dr. John Cacioppo today. And I'll tell you what, do yourself a favor and go back and listen to part one if you haven't heard it yet, because that's really the setup for what we're going to talk about today.
That's right. And, you know, we focused a lot on some of the research that Dr. Cacioppo did and some of the deleterious effects of loneliness. You know, there's an interesting negative feedback that happens there, right? So you're feeling lonely, you're more likely to be distracted, you're less likely to be able to control your impulses. So when you're trying to reconnect with people, you're not focused on them. That makes it harder to connect.
That's right. You're thinking about yourself more,
right? You're thinking about yourself. You're turning into yourself, which is a lonely self.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not going to help. And you're also more likely to be impulsive. You don't have the same impulse control. So if you're lonely and something goes badly, you're more likely to blame the other person, for instance, rather than, you know, try and regulate your feelings in that moment and try and smooth it over and try and reestablish a connection with the person in front of you who is likely to be innocent. I mean, that I think that's what some of his studies have shown. It's even when the person is innocent, you're still, as a lonely person, more likely to blame them.
That's right. That's right. So, and the fact is that your behavior is going to probably set off alarm bells in that other person who's going to say, well, you know, maybe I don't want to interact with this person. And then you find yourself more isolated.
Setting up this vicious circle.
Exactly.
But we're going to be talking about how to get out of that today.
That's right. With the expert, why don't you tell us a little bit about all of the awards Dr. Cacioppo has won?
Do we have a couple of hours? It's a lot. It's a long list. It's actually on his website. You can see this very long list, takes up a whole page. He's the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. He founded and is the director of the University of Chicago Center for Cognitive and Social Neuroscience. He's a member of the Department of Psychology, Department of Psychiatry. He's one of the founders of the field of social neuroscience, and he's been the president or past president of a long list of psychological associations, and he's won many awards for his work.
But wait, there's more. He's also the author of a 2008 book called Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection, which is one of the reasons why we're really excited to talk about him today, not just for all of his awards and all the research that he's done, but he really is the expert in the area of that social isolation and the negative effects that it has on people.
That's right. And, you know, we usually say enough about us. Let's get to the expert. And this is no different.
Let's get to the expert. We'll get him on the line right now.
Let's do it.
So partly we're wired to connect and partly we learn to connect over time.
Well, you know, it's like language. That capacity is neural. That's genetic. We have that capacity. But how it gets loaded depends on what languages we're exposed to, what experiences we have as we grow. So your capacity in language is determined by your environment. The capacity for language is part of our biology. And so I think connectivity is the same way. We're wired, if you will, to need connection and to be able to gain that. But what kind of early life experiences and later life experiences we have shapes exactly the kind of social creature that we are. And something like loneliness, as I explained with the timeout, actually contributes to us being able to shape very specialized, very customized social creatures.
So some of the research that you've done is focused on how, and I think I read it was more middle-aged people who tend to be lonely, who are lonely, tend to eat poorly, drink more alcohol, exercise less, and you link this to their impaired executive functions. So tell us about how this works and what exactly does that mean, executive functions, for people who don't know?
Yeah, it's a great question. Executive functioning is also, you could think of it as impulse control, all right? What we found maybe 12, 15 years ago is that the lonelier you feel, you perform tasks, these were attentional tasks, just like non-lonely, if it didn't take any effortful control. If it took self-discipline, or you're trying to overcome a habitual response, loneliness impaired the performance on the task. Roy Baumeister and his colleagues have done experiments since then where he tells people that he gives them false feedback. And he says, they have friends now, but as they grow older, they're going to lose all those friends and they're going to live an isolated life. They won't have friends. They're not going to get married. They won't have kids. They'll end up alone the rest of their life. Now, he says it in a way that turns out to be believable to people, and he finds that that impairs their impulse control. If they have the choice of doing something healthy or something like consuming junk food, they're much more likely to take the junk food. And so that's very much like what we see with this feeling of this chronic state of loneliness.
So he's experimentally creating a short period of fear of loneliness for people who may or may not have felt lonely prior to the experiment.
That's exactly right. Fear of, essentially he's putting them in a state in the future where they are isolated from other people. So it kind of creates that mental state, and then executive functioning is compromised.
You must have good friends on the ethics committee that passed that study.
I wondered the same thing, even when I read the papers to this day. But he's been able to do this research, and he's done very nice experiments of that kind. We then have looked at, we measure health behaviors in our study, and we have a longitudinal study of a random sample of what's called a population-based sample in Cook County. And we look at a variety of health behaviors, some of which take impulse control, like whether you go out and exercise, whether you eat fats and sugars, or whether you eat healthy. We measure all of that. But we also measure behaviors that don't take impulse control. Do you brush your teeth regularly? Do you floss? Do you wear a seatbelt, right? And what we find is that it's the impulse control behaviors that loneliness is likely to impair. And we see that looking at lonely and non-lonely people at a given point in time, but we also see it when we look longitudinally. When you feel lonely, you're more likely to fail to execute impulse control and exercise the bad behaviors that come from poor impulse control. When you don't feel lonely, you're likely to be able to maintain the self-discipline needed to engage in healthy behaviors. But that doesn't affect all these other health behaviors that don't take impulse control.
And of course, sleep problems are going to have an impact on your impulse control too. And we know that people who are lonely have some different sleeping patterns than people who aren't.
Right. That's right. In fact, we've shown that cross-sectionally. We've seen that longitudinally. So when you feel lonely, you sleep more poorly that night than when you don't feel lonely.
But the same number of hours, not necessarily fewer hours, right?
Right, right. That's a very good point. And the reason for that is that you show more micro-awakening. So let me put this in an evolutionary context because it'll make perfect sense. If you're sitting in evolutionary time with a stick trying to fend off wild beasts, that's a dangerous circumstance. But imagine how dangerous it is to lay that stick down to go to sleep at night when predators are out and you don't have a safe social surround. So what's going to happen is you're going to go to sleep because we're ultimately going to fall asleep, but you're going to sleep less soundly. You're going to be more easily disturbed by the breaking of a twig or by the rustle of leaves in a nearby area. And so what we see, in fact, in undergraduates, and we've seen this in older adults, is they show more what are called micro-awakenings. more fragmented sleep. They toss and turn, they're more easily aroused. They wake up, they fall right back asleep. They don't even know they awakened.
And so these connections to other people and the breaking of those connections is fundamental. It's a major part of who we are. And I would say so much so that that loneliness can fly under the radar and people don't notice necessarily that they're chronically lonely until they become depressed or anxious about it.
That's exactly right, until the negative consequences have manifest. And the interesting thing about the sleep is you don't have to be with someone. If you feel lonely and you have a spouse next to you in bed, you still show the sleep fragmentation. If you are not lonely and you're sleeping by yourself, you show sound sleep. I mean, it's not whether you're sleeping with someone. It's whether you, if you will, trust and feel comfortable, feel like you're connected to the person that's in your life, whether or not they're next to you in bed.
Right. So if you're feeling lonely, then it's harder for you to listen. You're more easily distracted. It makes it harder to connect to other people. What kind of advice do you have for people who are feeling lonely? I know you said something earlier about sort of doing things for others, but expand on that a little bit for us.
I think loneliness makes you concerned about your own welfare, but it also makes you really want to connect. So one of the things lonely individuals tend to do, and when I say lonely individuals, I'm talking about any of us when we become lonely, right? So, I mean, loners are not lonely individuals. Loners may not want to be around others. So that's a confusion sometimes people have. So it's not about whether somebody chooses to be alone. It's not bad to be alone sometimes. It's when you feel isolated, there are certain consequences that you're not, you know, that evolution in the brain are responsible for. And if we know what they are, they can actually be quite useful. If we see it as stigmatized, and so we try to hide it or deny it, even to ourselves, that can be damaging. So if one feels lonely, then it means I need to spend a little more time. You know, it's natural to connect. That doesn't mean we naturally connect in useful ways. Just like it's naturally to want to be happy, but when we try to make ourselves happy, we get less happy, right? So it means I need to attend to my relationships. And it isn't a lot of relationships. It's a few that mean something to you. So if I've moved to a new city and I'm feeling lonely, know what it's about and say, okay, what can I do to actually meet other people? And then you have to be patient. So I talk about what we say, the acronym of EASE. The E is to extend yourself. But extend yourself in a safe way. You extend yourself means get out of your house, go meet people. And sometimes going out and doing volunteer work in things that you enjoy anyway can be a way to meet those people. The second is know what loneliness does to you. You know, it makes you hostile. It makes you defensive. It makes you see others in a more hostile way. It makes you focused on yourself rather than others. That's all understandable. You're the one and your genes are the ones that are in danger. So if you know that, it isn't to discount that. It's to just know and interact and try to make an evaluation of what the person is actually doing rather than what we fear that they're doing to us. And the S is for similarity. If I want to find the rewarding relationship where the interaction is good for me and for the other person, the people I'm most likely to find that with are people with similar attitudes, similar values, similar interests, and engage in similar activities. You know, if I'm an academic and I love reading, going to a sports bar probably isn't the best place to find a new friend. And sometimes we go where other people are rather than other people like us are. And then the E is, if you find such individuals, nobody treats each other perfectly all the time. So it's to forgive, to be gracious in your interactions, to be concerned not only about yourself but others. That does not mean to become, you know, do things only for others. Being a doormat is not healthy. It's not sustainable. But good relationships, quality relationships are synergistic. Both are better as a result of the interaction most of the time. Both benefit. Again, there will be short periods of time where that's not the case, but you look not at every single episode, but over time at whether this is healthy for both. And that takes some patience so that you are certain that you find the person that's actually a great friend for both.
And how do you know if a relationship is a quality relationship of that type? Is there things that lonely people should be looking for?
Yeah, I think it's that you feel like you can actually trust that the person would be there for you and that you would not mind being there for that person, that there's a kind of joy that's just hanging out with the person, that they don't need to be doing anything for you to still enjoy their company. I mean, and it's not, you know, this is whether they're male or female. You good friends are those you just, there's just, it's fun being with them. It's fun talking to them. It's fun going to events with them. It's fun not going to events with them. I mean, that's something that comes with time, but that kind of synergism, that kind of going beyond, I'm paying you and I get something in return, right? Well, now there's rent-a-friend that's available, right? So you look like you have a friend. That's the epitome of instrumentality. There's that you have pseudo-relationships. That's you know, if you're feeling like that, then, and you may not be paying for the friend through a rental agency, but you may be paying for the friend there by things that you're doing for them. That's not a long-term healthy relationship. You have to feel like, you know, you can be authentic and they accept you for you and you like them for who they are. And it's not an instrumental, a pay-to-play relationship.
I think you said something about that in your book, like, you know, having someone drop in for regularly scheduled visits very briefly just to check in on you is not necessarily going to make you less lonely.
That's right. In fact, we just completed a meta-analysis, a statistical analysis of all the intervention studies that have been done to lower loneliness. And there's four major types of interventions that have been done. One is called social engagement. What that means is you take lonely people and you give them the opportunity to interact with other people. This is the notion that lonely is just not being with other people. That's not very effective, as it turns out. And you can see why. Lonely people are inherently somewhat self-centered. When we feel lonely, we're somewhat more self-centered. It's got a lot of such people together. They're happy at first, then they all want what's good for them, and they start to not like one another as much. And so that's not real effective. A second is social skills training. Most adults have the social skills that are needed. When they feel lonely, they just aren't thinking of the other person, so they're not exercising the appropriate social skills. Social skills training can be beneficial for a short term because it requires that you attend to the other person, but then you tend to retreat back to being concerned about yourself, so it doesn't have the same punch as one might expect. The third kind is social support. It's the kind you just suggested, where people come in, they check on you, they, you know, maybe bring you food or material. That turns out to be helpful, but not very helpful. Being needy, feeling like others have to take care of you, isn't exactly high-quality relationship. I mean, you might be grateful, but it doesn't really make you feel like you've got a great friend. So it's better than nothing, but it's not great. And then the fourth kind of intervention was where they actually worked on the person's, if you will, social cognition, how they thought about other people, how they perceived other people, very much along the lines that we're talking, along the lines of understanding what loneliness was doing to their own brain, why it was doing that, how they could understand that and therefore interact with other people in perhaps a more generous fashion than they otherwise would have, but not in a stupid fashion. You know, you don't want to be exploited by other people. If that's happening, you can forgive them, but don't forget. Just go find other people who can be your real friends, because real friends, you know, are good to you in return. And so that kind of training turned out to have an effect that was three times bigger than the other kinds of treatments. That's what we found in the meta-analysis.
And that kind of training, that's, I guess, in the cognitive behavior model, is looking at their cognitive distortions, things that they're misinterpreting about their relationship with other people, and trying to challenge those thoughts and change those thoughts, and that affects how they behave.
That's exactly right. That's it. Teaching them that, you know, being genuine to other, you know, some people don't present genuine images of themselves as they get to know someone because they think the person won't like them. What's ironic about that is ultimately they want to be able to be genuine. By then, you know, to lose them as a friend is much more painful. And so that, of course, makes them anxious while they're friends, or putative friends. So partly it's be authentic. You know, if the person isn't going to like you as an authentic person, there are other people who could be friends. You know, it's not a world with one potential friend out there. And so it's really about being true to you and being good to other people, but looking for those who you can be genuine and they're genuine with you. And then you develop a true trusting, true relationship with someone.
So what about like people who see lonely people in their lives and they want to help them in some way? What would you suggest for them?
One is a gentleness, an understanding of what the other person is doing. If they were acting toward me in a kind of an aggressive, hostile, irritable fashion or depressive fashion, to know that that's because they feel disconnected and are focusing on their own. You know, they feel threatened. They may not know it, but they feel threatened. And so to kind of embrace them, much like you would a child after time out, just kind of be more understanding and reassuring and to actually be authentic and genuine. Now, if over time they didn't get over that, then I would have a talk with them, because no one, you know, wants somebody who's just needy and just eating them alive. But to be gentle about that conversation and patient with their moving out of that could be really a great support for a person in such a state.
So being gentle and remembering where some negative behavior might be coming from can be really important. And that's something that translates very well to parents with their kids, because I know lots of parents have kids who come home from school and they say those words that none of us like to hear from our children: I have no friends.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, as a junior high kid, you know, junior high students tend to be really good at rejecting each other, right? That's And I remember as a kid that age, I went to this party and there was a group of friends who rejected me at the party. I mean, I was kind of stunned by it. And I remember walking away being really upset and irritable and wanting to turn around and kind of go pound them. And then I thought, wait, you know, that's never been like that. That's not. And instead I turned around and I went back. I was just really gentle. I didn't push my way in. I was just nice to them. And I didn't expect anything in return. And then I walked off, and in about, you know, I was talking to somebody else, in about 30 minutes, an hour, the kid who was the most rejecting of the set came over to me and was very nice, and the rejection was over. So, it was just fortuitous, because I came very close to reacting as, you know, in the impulsive way that we all would. So it was just very, very fortunate I, for whatever reason, acted in that fashion, but it led them to, if you will, unreject that evening. Now, it's not always that fast, but that's the kind of compassion. If we see somebody, if we can do that to them, then they start to relax. They feel less threatened by your presence.
Dr. Cacioppo, it's been fascinating talking to you about this really, really important topic. More and more we're hearing about how important relationships are, and you're looking at the other end of the spectrum too. So thank you so much for joining us today. How can our listeners track you down?
They can put my name in Google and they will get my faculty webpage. And they can read the original research. There's links there. They can find books that we've written from that, whatever they're interested in finding. It can be found through that page.
Listen, Dr. Cacioppo, thanks very much for being on Family Anatomy, and we've really enjoyed having you.
Thank you for your time. I enjoyed this. A great deal.
So there you have it, another fascinating interview with Dr. John Cacioppo.
He is an easy guy to talk to, that's for sure, and he is doing such important, and we can't emphasize enough this relationship thing. It seems like every single time we sit down together, we're talking about attachment, relationships, and just exactly these kinds of issues. It's become the driving philosophy, almost, I would say, for modern psychology.
And, you know, the interesting thing is, if you think about the trend in society, like we were talking earlier, that people have fewer people that they report saying they feel comfortable talking about personal issues. There's more dislocation. People move away in different parts of the world more than they used to. Larger numbers of people are reporting feeling lonely. And at the same time, there's all this new research coming back at us to remind us. It's almost as if on a macro level, the way we're going with society is triggering all these people to recognize how important connection is. And that's why we're getting this wave. So that's it for us. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. And as usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love. And he is over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening. A family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com